Psalm 77. The psalmist Asaph cried earnestly in the night from a troubled spirit, searching his soul for an answer to his distress. Yet no answer could be found. He traced through his memory. He poured out his heart to God. He searched his Bible. But the depths of his hurt held him as a prisoner of despair. And so Asaph recorded his troubled thoughts and sent them to Jeduthun. Asaph and Jeduthun? Who are these guys? Well, if you look at the little title to the psalm, Psalm 77, the little fine print right above right above verse 1, it says, to the chief musician, to Jeduthun, a psalm of Asaph. These are the words of Asaph. This is the record of his troubled thoughts. And he wrote them down and he sent them to Jeduthun, whom he called the chief musician. Who are these guys? Asaph and Jeduthun. Well, you've got a couple of passages there on your little worksheet tonight. 1 Chronicles 25 and 2 Chronicles 5. You'll find them mentioned in those references. In 1 Chronicles 25 in verse 1, the Bible says, moreover, David and his captains of the host separated to the service of the sons of Asaph and of Heman and of Jeduthun, who should prophesy with harps, with psalteries, and with cymbals. The number of the workmen according to their service was. And if you read down through verse number 7 of that passage, the Bible lists the children of those three men, Asaph and Heman and Jeduthun, and lists their children, and lists some of the instruments they played, and some of the role that they played in the music ministry at the tabernacle. You see, David was the king of Israel, and they had quite a choir there in Israel. They had quite an orchestra there in Israel, and they had three men, Asaph, Heman, and Jeduthun, who were responsible as the song leaders, as the music ministers, as the ones who organized the music ministry of the tabernacle. And their children followed in the footprints of their dads. And the Bible mentions the different instruments their kids played and the different roles that they played. Their sons were all involved in the music ministry at the tabernacle. Years later, David died, and Solomon built the permanent temple. And in 2 Chronicles chapter 5, verse number 12, Solomon is bringing the Ark of the Covenant into the newly constructed temple to dedicate the temple and to place the Ark of the Covenant in its proper place. And they did that. They had these men, Asaph and Heman and Jeduthun and all of their sons and all of the music ministry. Now it's the permanent temple and the choir and the orchestra and all the music ministry of Israel is in full array. And the Bible says in 2 Chronicles 5 and verse 12, also the Levites, which were the singers, all of them of Asaph and of Heman and of Jeduthun, with their sons and their brethren, being arrayed in white linen. We should have put the choir in white suits and dresses this morning. Dazzling white, you know, throw a little bit of glitter on it. In white linen, having cymbals and psalteries and harps. And if you were to turn to that passage and read the rest of that passage, down through verse number 14, you find that there they played and they praised God and they led Israel to rejoice in what God had done for them. And the Shekinah glory of God came and filled the brand new temple. The Ark of the Covenant was placed there. Music ministry is important. Music ministry is organized. It's important. It's vital. And it's a major part of the blessings of God. By the way, if you were to look carefully in the 1 Chronicles 25 passage, the Bible says that David separated to the service the sons of Asaph and of Hebat and of Jeduthun, listen carefully, who should prophesy with harps, psalteries, and with cymbals. They preached with their music. You understand that musicians are preachers. That's where we allow women preachers. Musicians, choir members, are preachers. They're proclaimers of truth. That's why as it is important for a preacher or a teacher to live a godly life and to get up and preach and teach from a life of obedience, it is also important for a choir member to live a holy life and to sing the truth of God from the foundation of holiness and godliness. We need to be ministered to by leaders who are spirit-filled. Worldly preachers can't do that. Worldly teachers can't do that. Worldly orchestra members can't do that. Worldly choir members can't do that. How you live through the week is important before you get up on Sunday and sing the truth of God to a congregation. Because music is a part of the preaching, the proclamation, the prophecy ministry of a church, proclaiming God's truth from godly people, preaching, teaching, and singing truth to God's people. And so they put these men in place, Asaph and Heman and Jeduthun. Their families took the roles and places and responsibilities that were important for them to take, and they were called prophets. They prophesied through their music ministry to proclaim truth. What I'm wanting you to understand is that these people that we know of as Asaph and Heman and Jeduthun, these chief musicians, these leaders of the music ministry of Israel, were really important people in the work of God. And they were godly people. And they were spiritual leaders in the ministry of God in the Old Testament. One of them was a man by the name of Asaph. And he's in despair. He has a broken heart. He has a troubled spirit. He is aching in agony. And he can't find an answer to his despair. And he records his thoughts and he sends them to one of the other chief musicians that is in a like role that he plays. And he writes to his friend about the despair that has engulfed his soul. Hey, if the preacher can be in despair, how about you? Can you be in despair? If the song leader can be in despair, how about you? Can you have problems that push you to the limit? If the leaders in the church have problems that leave them in agony, awake at night, searching their hearts and searching their scriptures and can't find an answer, how about you? I would say that every one of us live lives that at times struggle with deep problems that leave us in panic, in fear, in despair, with no answers. And that's where we find Asaph in Psalm 77. And when we read this psalm, we learn that this spiritual leader of Israel, whose ministry it is to lead everybody else to praise God, their ministry purpose is to stand and to lead the choir and to lead the orchestra and to lead the people who lead the nation of Israel in worshiping Jehovah God. I mean, these are the top guys in worship, ministry, and leadership. And if they're broken with a troubled spirit, then maybe it would help me to understand what was going on in their life and the struggle that they went through. And I want to say tonight that as Asaph was able to move from panic to praise in Psalm 77, I can too. And you can too. If you will learn what Asaph learned, that he recorded in Psalm 77 and sent it to one of the other praise leaders, worship leaders, chief musicians. I mean, this is important. This can help me in my life. I believe this can help all of us in our lives. The question is this: is peace really possible in despair? Is peace really possible in despair? But you see that there are two stages of searching for peace when you're in despair. The first stage is a stage of failure. Failure to find peace. Look at what Asaph has to say. You'll see two things here in verses 1 to 9. And by the way, this psalm is one of the psalms that are really easy to figure out the flow of it because you keep running into that word Selah. At the end of verse number 3, do you see it? Verse number 3 ends with the word Selah. Verse number 9 ends with the word Selah. Verse number 15 ends with the word Selah. And verse number, well, the end of it doesn't end with the word Selah, it just ends. But the psalm is broken into four parts by this word Selah. Now, you know what Selah means. Selah just means stop a minute and think about what you just said, what you just read. It was a musical rest. And it was put in the music to tell the people to stop. Old James Crumpton, he's in heaven today, but old James Crumpton from Natchez, Mississippi, when he was reading the Psalms publicly in church, whenever he would come to Selah, he wouldn't read the word Selah. He would be reading down through the Psalm and he would come to the word Selah and he would pause and he would say, in his southern gentleman, he was a big old 6 foot something, white haired southern gentleman, and he would say when he came to that word, he would stop and he would say, well, just think of that. And that's what the word Selah is there for. Stop. What did you just read? Before you go on, did you capture what God just said? And so you'll see that throughout this psalm. I want you to notice that Asaph met failure to find peace. And you'll find that, first of all, in verses 1 to 3, the first little section of the psalm, Asaph, in despair, with a troubled heart, prayed, but prayer didn't work. He said, I cried unto God with my voice. Even unto God with my voice, and he gave ear to me. He knew God heard him. I mean, he was the song leader of Israel. He was a godly man. He was one of the top three chief musicians. He knew God, and he knew God heard prayer. And he said, God, I'm crying to you. I'm crying from the depths of my soul, and I know you hear me, God. Verse number 2, he says, in the day of my trouble, I sought the Lord. My sore ran in the night and ceased not. My soul refused to be comforted. You need to stop and get a feel for what this man is saying. He said, all night long, I was in agony. Whatever it was that was pressed upon his heart, we don't know. Whatever it was that put his back to the wall, that put him in the midst of despair, it held him awake all night long. And through the night, he said, my sore ran in the night and ceased not. Whatever it was that would trouble him, just haunted him at 11 o'clock and midnight and 1 o'clock and 2 o'clock and 3 in the morning. He can't get to sleep all through the night. It won't stop. It is driving him crazy. And he knows God's aware of it. He knows God can hear him. He said, I remembered God. Verse number 3. I remembered God and was troubled. I want you to see that he prayed. But God didn't seem to even care. He begged God, but prayer didn't bring him any comfort. He knew God could hear him, but he couldn't sense God was speaking. And so he said, I can't find any comfort. I remembered God and was troubled. I complained and my spirit was overwhelmed. Here we see a picture of a spiritual leader in the midst of such turmoil and brokenness and trouble and distress that all night long he tosses and turns on his bed. He complains to God, God, why won't you answer? God, why won't you do something about this? And all night long he prays and he prays and he prays, but his prayer doesn't do him any good. He finds no peace in prayer. He complains to God and he's overwhelmed by the silence of God. Then I want you to notice the number 2 there on your little worksheet. We're talking about failure to find peace. Prayer brought no relief. And then in the second section of the psalm, we learn that remembering better days brought no relief. Look at verse number 4. He said to God, God, thou holdest mine eyes waking. God, you won't let me fall asleep. I can't get to sleep. I'm so troubled. I can't even put it in words. I can't speak. God, I am just so overwhelmed. I can't articulate the condition of my heart. He said, I have considered the days of old, the years of ancient times. He said, so I began to remember history. I began to let my mind go back in the past. I began to think about what has happened in the past. And he said in verse 6, I called to remembrance my songs in the night. I remember my better days. I remember the good times. I remember when everything was great in my life. I laid there, couldn't sleep at night. God wouldn't let me go to sleep, so I laid there and I rehearsed my life. And I remember times in my life where everything was wonderful. I remember how good it felt. The blessings of God, the hand of God on my life. I went back and I remembered the history of better days. I thought about God's blessing in my life. And my spirit, I communed with my own heart. That means he talked to himself. He said, Mike, you remember back when God did this? Mike, you remember back there when this happened? Mike, you remember back when... And he talked to himself about his own better days. But notice what he said at the end of verse number 6. He says, my spirit made diligent search. He wants to know why God won't talk to him now. Where are you, God? Don't you see what I'm going through? Don't you see the agony of my life? God, it's not been this way in the past. In the past, I remember when you did this in my life and you did this in my life. And he talked to himself and he made diligent search of his life. And then in verses 7 to 9, the questions are just, it's just hard to wrap your arms around how deep in pain Asaph was. He says, will the Lord cast off forever? God, are you done with me? Are you done with me, God? And will he be favorable no more? God, is there nothing else favorable that you can do in my life? God, have I done something so bad that there's nothing ever good going to come again in my life? God, are you finished with me as your child? Is his mercy clean, gone forever? Will I never have mercy from God again? God, what is going on? Where are you, God? Don't you care? And will you never help me again? Is it over? Verse 8 says, is his mercy clean gone forever? Doth his promise fail forevermore? Hath God forgotten to be gracious? Hath he in anger shut up his tender mercies? Well, just think about that. Asaph can't find peace. He can't find peace in prayer. He can't find peace in remembering what God had done in his life earlier. And he ends with complaining to God, saying, God, are you so angry with me that it's all over? No more fulfilled promises. No more mercy. No more grace. No more favor. It's all over. God is so angry with me that I have no hope. Asaph, as a spiritual leader, is in despair. He's trying to find peace, but it's failing him. He can't find peace in prayer. He can't find peace in remembering the better days in his life. He is in the midst of despair. Now, at that point in the psalm, there's a drastic change, a dramatic shift at that point in the psalm. And at this point in the psalm takes a totally different path as he expresses his thoughts to his chief musician friend, Jeduthun. And this second stage of the psalm, I want to call it the secret to finding peace. And we find two statements that I'm supplying to describe what he is saying. The first statement is this: I will not blame God. I like that. Did you see it in verse number 10? Verse number 10, and I said, this is my infirmity. He owns up to the situation he's in. He doesn't blame God for it. He doesn't say, God, this is your fault. God, I don't deserve this. I'm better than this. You're not being fair, God. I like that. I like it when someone stands up and says, I'll take responsibility. I like that. I like it when someone has enough character about them that they don't find someone else to blame. They don't try to push it off on somebody else. They have enough character to stand up and say, I'll take responsibility for that. That was my decision. And I see that in Asaph. Asaph says, this is my infirmity. I'm complaining. God, are you so mad at me? Have I done so wrong? Have I done so wrong, God, that you're mad at me? And then he said, but I'm not going to blame God for the situation I'm in. I will take ownership of my situation. This is my infirmity. And then he begins to defend God. Look at how he does that in verse number 10. Verse number 10, he says, but I will remember the years of the right hand of the Most High. I will remember the works of the Lord. Surely I will remember thy wonders of old. I will meditate also of all thy work and talk of thy doings. I like verse number 13. He said, thy way, O God, is in the sanctuary. Who is so great a God as our God? Thou art the God that doest wonders. Thou hast declared thy strength among the people. Thou hast with thine arm redeemed thy people, the sons of Jacob and Joseph. Well, just think of that. You see, Asaph takes ownership. He said, this is my problem. It isn't God's fault. This is my infirmity. And then he begins to defend the character of God. I like it when people defend the character of God instead of blaming God. If God really did care, he would. Well, if God really had, he would. You know, God takes a bad rap a lot of times, doesn't he? He doesn't blame God. He takes ownership and then he defends God. You see that in the 22nd Psalm, the Psalm of the Cross, you know, when Jesus Christ, the psalmist opens up Psalm 22, verse 1, my Lord, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? And then you go through that 22nd Psalm and you're reading the supernatural account of the mind of Jesus Christ while he was hanging on the cross. You see what was going through his mind. The Gospels record what people saw and what people heard as they stood there and watched him die. But Psalm 22 records the inside heart of Jesus Christ. It tells us what was going through his mind, what he was thinking, how he was feeling One of the great things about Psalm 22 is how Jesus Christ defended God the Father. He defended God. He said, God has not done me wrong as I hang on this cross. I like it when people defend God. Asaph is defending God. Don't look at my situation and say, God doesn't really love His children. Don't look at my situation and say, God must not care. Asaph comes to God's defense and he begins to defend God in these verses. You know, the beginning of finding peace in the midst of despair in your life is to not blame God, but rather defend Him. He is a good God. You may not understand His goodness all the time, but He's good. He is a great God. You may not understand why He's doing what He's doing or why He doesn't do what you'd like for Him to do. He is a good God. He is a kind God. He is a merciful God. He is a gracious God. And when we don't understand, we should still defend Him. Asaph doesn't understand. Defending God didn't make the pain go away. Defending God didn't take away the problem that had his back to the wall. But defending God was the right thing to do. Because in the midst of his despair, God is not at fault. And God has done no wrong. And so he takes ownership of the problem, and then he defends God. And it runs right down through verse number 15. But I want you to see, in closing, I want you to see the thing that made the difference. What made the difference between verse number 9 and verse number 10? Why, up until verse number 9, is Asaph crying and complaining and questioning and wondering if God is so angry at him that there's never going to be anything good come in his life? Why did he? What is the secret of going from despair to verse number 10 to 15, where he defended God's name so that no one would think God had faulted him or done wrong? What made the difference? What turned Asaph from fear to faith? What turned him from panic to praise? What was it that made the difference in Asaph's life that night in his little room on the side of the temple in despair all night long that enabled him to write the ending of this psalm and send it to Jeduthun? I want to suggest to you that as he sat in his room that night with a flickering candle and a piece of paper and a pen, as he recorded his thoughts, he relived the story of how Israel were backed into a corner at the end of a dead-end alley with no place to go and nothing to do but to be butchered by Pharaoh's angry army or willingly march into the raging waters of the Red Sea and drown. There was no answer. There was nothing they could do. They were angry at Moses for leading them there. They were blaming everybody else for the situation. They knew they were going to die that night. They were in total panic and fear. They were in despair. And they were ready to die. And Asaph ends his psalm reliving that night when Israel was at the bank of the Red Sea. Verse number 16. The waters saw thee, O God. The waters saw thee. They were afraid. The depths also were troubled. The clouds poured out water. The skies sent out sound. Thine arrows also went abroad. The voice of thy thunder was in the heaven, and the lightnings lightened the world, and the earth trembled and shook. Wow. What a description of what happened that night on the banks of the Red Sea.
2.5 million people backed into a corner by the angry army of Pharaoh on their chariots. We will annihilate these Jews. And they were walled in by the mountains on either side of them. Behind them was that army of chariots rushing down to annihilate them. And in front of them was a sea. And all of a sudden, the heavens began to roar. The rain came down in sheets of water. The sky rolled with thunder. Lightning crashed down to earth. An earthquake shook the ground they were standing on. And God opened up the sea. And the waters moved to either side and formed pillars, walls of water, revealing to those Jewish people a highway, a pathway, right through the midst of the sea. And with walls on either, mountains on either side of them, an army rushing down to annihilate them, and a massive body of water with thunder and lightning and shaking ground and torrential downpour. God opened up the sea and they ran through the sea on a highway and escaped that which was causing them all of their despair. And when they got to the other side, that highway God created for their deliverance, that sea that was there for their destruction became their deliverance. And as soon as they got to the other side and Pharaoh's army chasing them through the sea on the highway, God reached down and let go of the walls of water. And they came crashing down on Pharaoh's army. And all grew still and quiet. There on the other side of the sea. In peace and in calm, as the waters settled down, the shield would wash up, a piece of armor would wash up, a body would wash up, and they knew God had done what they couldn't do. God rescued them from despair. And Asaph penned the words of verse number 19. He said, "Thy way is in the sea." God, your way through this problem in my life. God, your way through this dilemma that has put my back against the wall. God, your way to get me through this horrendous problem I'm facing. God, your way is a path that I couldn't go unless you open it up. It's a fix that I could never conjure up on my own. It's your pathway, God. Thy path is in the great waters, and thy footsteps are not known. As that water opened up a highway through the Red Sea, there, looking down on that highway, you, no human eyes have ever seen that ground before. God's footsteps leading them through their despair and through their problem and through that destructive, raging force of the Red Sea. God's footsteps have never been seen before. And you know something? When God opens up the way for you in your despair, it will not be something you could explain. It's not something that you could have seen before. It's not something that you could have understood before. It's God at work in your life. Thy way, thy path. And as Asaph relived the story of the Red Sea crossing, something happened in his troubled soul. And he went from verses 1 to 9 to verses 10 to 16. 10 to the end. What happened in his heart? I'll tell you what happened in his heart. He meditated on the Red Sea crossing. And when he thought through the experience of Israel and what God did, he gained strength from the experience of recorded in Exodus 14 and the strength he received from reliving the experience of Exodus 14 enabled him to go from verse 9 to verse number 10. I want you to know the secret to peace in the midst of despair is found hidden in the story of the Red Sea. And in coming Sunday nights, we're going to learn 10 life principles. We'll call them 10 rules. The Red Sea rules. 10 rules that give us the secret to how to get through the turmoil that has put my back against the wall and turns me from despair to excitement about what God has done. It turns me from fear to faith and from panic to praise. And in those 10 principles, we find hope. I'm going to enjoy them. I hope you do. I think we'll all enjoy them, by the way. If you're really interested in getting into this thing, in our bookstore, there are two books. The Red Sea Rules, written by a preacher by the name of Robert Morgan. He's the one that identified. We're going to use his 10 life principles, or he calls them rules, life rules, learned from the Red Sea experience. Little hardback gift booklet. We saw the little promotional clip this morning. I think they're $7, I think, in the bookstore, right through that door over there, at the end of the hallway, past the bathrooms. And then there's another one that goes, it kind of goes with it, the Red Sea Rules Study Guide. And it's a study guide that was put together to help a person through the week to be able to go through the 10 life principles, life rules. If you really want to get into this thing and you want to get the most out of it, then you may want to pick up one or both of these books, and you may want to make this a little bit of a personal study through the week at home as we spend our Sunday evenings giving consideration to these great 10 life principles. There are some principles in that experience that hundreds of years later helped Asaph get through a sleepless night and realize that his God could fix what was wrong in his life.